Okay, first of all, I want to thank Chris and Felicity and everyone else who's involved in the organization of this conference, and Jim Good for so many years as being the editor of History of the Human Sciences. And what I want to talk about today, and I think Roger in a way introduced kind of where I'm going to come at this, because I do think that there is an issue here about what the object of inquiry is with regard to the human sciences. And when we talk about the history of it, if you have a certain kind of standpoint toward history, the use of the word history is redundant. Okay? This is where I talk about in the title of the paper what I call the curse of Kuhn. And if you know something about Thomas Kuhn, one of the things about him that doesn't get talked about very much by his followers, but I think is very essential to the way in which he conducted history, was that he believed that you could only do history of a period or an object that was already closed, right? So in other words, it was dead. And so there's a very clear distinction in his mind, and this is what accounts, so this, you know, if you know about Thomas Kuhn's own background, he was someone who received a PhD in contemporary physics, and was someone who was actually trained to be able to do frontline physics, and because of experiences in World War II and all the rest of it, he decided to become the historian and philosopher that we know him to be. But at the same time, he was very careful in terms of the kinds of history that he did of physics, that it basically, he terminated his historical understanding at the point at which it was pretty clear the issues involved in a particular dispute were resolved. Right? So there was closure. So as it were, history itself provides the object of inquiry by giving a kind of natural sense of closure, and then the historian comes in to do the autopsy, basically. Okay? And so there's this very clear distinction between what the historian does and, let's say, what some more contemporary person does. And of course, when we're doing contemporary works in the humanities or the sciences, we're of course dealing with issues that of course have a historical pedigree, but because that pedigree is still alive and kicking, it is not an object of history. Right? There's still some issues open, and that's for the contemporary practitioners to do. And what the historian does is the stuff that's already closed and dead, because that gives it a kind of natural boundary to what you're talking about. This is, I think, a very important kind of issue, and I don't think it's a completely unfamiliar issue with regard to history generally. Especially if you want to talk about history as having a discrete object of inquiry, where, as it were, time operates kind of the way space does normally, where the past is this kind of foreign country, right, different from what it is in the present. Now, in the case of this particular journal, History of the Human Sciences, of course, from the very beginning, a very influential kind of intellectual presence was Foucault. And the kind of Foucault that I think is relevant from the standpoint of what we're talking about here is the Foucault of the Order of Things and the Archaeology of Knowledge, where there's definitely a sense in the case of Foucault that the human has come and gone. Okay, that there's a sense in which the human as an object began to emerge as a distinctive object, let's say in the late 18th century, and already by the time we're entering into the 19th century with Nietzsche and Freud and Marx, and certainly by the time Foucault is writing in the middle of the 20th century, that this object is heading into the sunset. Right? I think that's very much kind of the horizon that Foucault provides. And so this is actually quite compatible with the kind of Kuhnian, you know, so in other words, you can do a Kuhnian-style history of the human sciences if you have Foucault's view of the human. Right? Because the human's dead, or it's dying, right? And so in a sense, the historians are just waiting to get in to do the autopsy. Right? And they're sort of circling like vultures, intellectual vultures, around the corpse of the human, right? And so all of the popularity of the post-human and maybe even the transhuman sort of lives on the back of that kind of sensibility, which I think is very much a default pattern of perhaps people in this room. Right, that in some sense, one of the reasons why the history of the human sciences is such an intriguing and interesting topic is because who killed it? How did it happen? Right, who's burying it? Right, I mean, I think that's kind of the spirit in which one enters into this matter. I don't quite have this viewpoint, actually. In fact, my viewpoint is really quite different, and I have a rather different view about history, but I do think that, you know, we should put this on the table to begin with. Now, I think one reason why the kind of position I've just outlined is not seen quite as clearly as it could be is I blame Ian Hacking for that, And that's because Ian Hacking superimposes on Foucault a kind of, you know, Roger Smith-like Geisteswissenschaft kind of thing, right? And so those of you who know about the difference between the social kinds and the natural kinds that Ian Hacking pontificates about in The Social Construction of What? That's not coming from Foucault, right? That's some sort of imported thing from neo-Kantianism, which then gets slapped onto Foucault. Because Foucault's perspective is much closer to something like Heidegger's, right? Where in a sense what the history is really about in some kind of ultimate way is about the history of being, and the human is a moment in that history, right? Which kind of comes and goes, just like the tide, right? And so just as a human comes into being at one point, it disappears at another point. But that's really quite different from the sort of ontology and metaphysical orientation that animates the Geisteswissenschaft, right? Which actually wants to say that there's some ontological distinction between the human and the natural, and it becomes very important to maintain that because you want to protect things like autonomy, free will, and all these other distinctive human kinds of things. And Ian Hacking, in a way, wants to do that with his idea of splitting the different kinds of kind. But it doesn't come from Foucault. This is just something he's slapping onto this. But of course, this confuses everyone. And so as a result, we live in this kind of hybrid intellectual space where we still have this kind of remnant of the Geisteswissenschaft, where there's a still human-natural distinction. But it's against the general kind of Foucauldian, Heideggerian backdrop that the human is just a moment in the history of being. And that really, the subject is the history of being. Okay? And so I think this is kind of where we are at the moment, and I think it helps to explain why things like transhumanism and posthumanism are kind of where they are at the moment, okay? Because there's a sense in which we're living in a time that for several different kinds of reasons is questioning a kind of Geisteswissenschaftlich orientation of the human, namely the idea that the human is clearly separate from the non-human or the natural, okay? And whether or not one wants to buy into particular ways of showing this blurring, nevertheless, that's happening there. It's happening from many different directions. Part of it is the perception of human beings more embedded in the natural world, and this is not just the product of neuroscience. In fact, I think neuroscience, in a way, is just a relatively small part of the general kind of issue of the environment and the ecology and that kind of naturalization of the human condition that's taking place, okay? And I think that very much propels the post-human sensibility, right? That there's a sense in which one has to start thinking about, as it were, the locus of value in being as not being so clearly centered on the human, but in some much more generic sense of life, right? And where the human is just one kind of life, and as it were, its significance needs to be dealt with in relation to the other forms of life that are around, okay? So that's a kind of a decentering of the human from the value of life, and I think that's very much part of the post-human condition. But then there's another strand to this, and this is the transhuman side, and this is the side that I'm mostly associated with. And the transhuman side basically isn't ashamed of talking about the human, and in fact is quite happy in a way to talk about the sort of Geisteswissenschaft sort of things, like what distinguishes the human from everything? What is it that humans have that nothing else has kind of thing? I'm quite happy with that. The question is whether the biological body of the human is the best place to realize it. Okay? So in other words, you want to talk about things like rationality and consciousness and all these other kinds of things. And of course it is true from the standpoint of biological evolution that over the course of billions of years, we have come to be the beings that instantiate and embody these particular highly valued qualities like rationality, consciousness, etc. But does it follow that in the future, given our capacities, that we need to remain on this platform? In other words, could we not transform into more cyborg or maybe even uploaded forms of existence that in a way can better realize the qualities that historically have distinguished the human from the non-human? Right? And this is what transhumanism is putting on the table for you, right? Transhumanism is not anti-human at all. If anything, it's ultra-human. Okay? In other words, it wants to really kind of take very seriously the idea that there's something very distinctive about the human. But the issue is whether remaining in the biological body of the human in the way it has been delivered through evolutionary theory is going to be a sufficient way to carry this forward in the future. Okay? So this is a view that in a way is very radically anti-Foucauldian. Right? The human is not dead. It's going to be resurrected. right? That's the thing, right? And I think so I think you know, when we talk about the history of the human sciences, in terms of what the object of inquiry is, what is the human in all this, becomes very interesting. Now, if you take this notion of the human that I'm putting forward here from transhumanism, as a kind of, you might say, more conceptual notion of the human. In other words, it's a notion of the human that doesn't need to be tied to a particular physical instantiation. It could be multiply instantiated. Then, you know, it starts to make sense of certain kinds of trends that are around now. And I want to make a distinction here in what follows. We have these two words in English. One of them is anthropocentric, and the other is anthropomorphic. And I want to draw a distinction between these two terms. Because both of them are obviously, in some sense, about the human, but it's basically about how the human relates to other things. Okay? Now, the first thing I would want to say about anthropocentric is that science and any kind of form of systematic inquiry to try to understand things is anthropocentric. In other words, it comes from us. But it doesn't follow that it's anthropomorphic in terms of what it's trying to understand. Right? And this is kind of the challenge of science, in a sense. That science, in a sense, is something that originates with human beings, and it deals with things like human conceptual frameworks, and if you think about the history and philosophy of science, it's all about how do you overcome, as it were, the conditions of being human in order to get to understand everything. Right? So it's anthropocentric, but it's not trying to be anthropomorphic. It's trying to understand what goes beyond. Now, if you look at anthropomorphic, okay, I think that a lot of the attempts that have been made at the political level, let's say, to incorporate animals and to incorporate other kinds of beings into the human life world to give them rights, to give them some kind of recognition and standing and so forth, is not anthropocentric in the sense that it actually would involve the delegation and the spreading out and the distribution of power and responsibility away from human beings, but nevertheless, it's done in the spirit as one would do to other humans. Right? The old idea of giving rights, for example. So you give rights to animals just like you gave rights to women. Right? That's basically how it goes. Okay? And that's anthropomorphic. It's not necessarily anthropocentric, though. Okay? And in fact, these things are generally sort of regarded as very positive steps in getting a kind of, the expanded moral circle, things of that kind that Peter Singer and others have talked about. And that requires, nevertheless, a conception of the human as a kind of grounding notion. So both with the sense of science that we have and the sense of politics that we have, there are these grounding conceptions of the human, even though both of them aspire to go beyond the beings that we normally call human. Okay? And so there's a sense in which there's actually quite a lot at stake, you might say, from a normative standpoint, with regard to retaining the category of human, however that object in the future is defined. Okay? Now, in terms of defining that object, the human, I mean, I think one of the things that is very interesting, of course, when you do the history of the human sciences, especially when you think of it as part of the history of the social sciences generally, is that there is this, if you had to tell the story from ground zero, you'd probably tell it in terms of, in the beginning there were the apes, or there were animals or something, and then through some kind of evolutionary process, and you can make the cut point somewhere, 40,000 years ago when the brain gets to be the way it is, whatever, then you have this kind of human story, and the human is basically this biological being that often had a difficult time recognizing each other as a member of the same species and so forth, but nevertheless, this is what we're talking about, and their self-conception, self-understandings and so forth. And so it's a kind of it's sort of a history that, regardless of how much people are willing or not willing to talk about biology, is traced through the biology of these biologically individuated beings called humans, Homo sapiens, basically. Okay. Now, one of the things that I think that transhumanism puts on the table is the possibility that if you really want to talk about the history of the human, you have to think about the biological phase of our condition as maybe just one phase. And that we may be moving to a much more technologically motivated stage that when we get to the point where, as it were, most of the human condition is technologically instantiated or driven or something like that, we will, in retrospect, see biology, as it were, as only one way in which our humanity came to be realized. But in fact, the history of technology may in fact provide another way in which humanity was realized. Especially if we start to identify ourselves much more closely with computers, right? If computers and computational technology becomes the main platform in which the human condition is realized, let's say in the next century or two, when we do the history in retrospect, the history of that development within technology may come to be seen as, in fact, the dominant strand through which we became to be the human beings we are now. Okay? So this is a very important aspect of the issue. And this is one of the reasons why this is part of this general argument of not being Foucauldian, right? In other words, keeping quite open what the human is. I mean, I think the Foucauldian vision of the human as a kind of closing space, as it were, that is being reabsorbed into the natural world, is very much determined by a kind of idea that a human being is nothing more than a spiritualized ape. And where historically, I think the self-consciousness of the human as human came from that kind of development, it nevertheless need not be the development in which it goes forward in the future. Now, I want to say one more thing before going forward. I don't know how much time do I have. I'm okay with time? Okay. Last night before I got here, I was at the Edinburgh Science Festival, and there was this discussion. I was on the panel with Aubrey de Grey, if you know, the man who believes we can live for 1,000 years, and Raymond Tallis, who doesn't believe that, and he's a gerontologist, and so he's got some biology at his fingertips. But the thing that was interesting was about how one reads the history to inform this kind of debate about how long human beings could live and whether there's a sense in which we have reason to believe from history that in fact we are just on the verge of making this great breakthrough that enabled human beings to live forever, okay? It was very interesting because both sides of the argument appeal to history, and Raymond Tallis was basically saying, look, If there were all these great secrets for reversing the aging process and stopping it from happening and all the rest of it, then evolution would have discovered it by now in some other species. Okay? Whereas Aubrey de Grey was arguing, if you look at the history of technology, it is so markedly different from the history of biology in terms of the speed and the innovation capacity and all the rest of it. And this is something that makes human beings quite distinctive, in that, in fact, we might actually be able to accomplish something within the next generation or two that the last 4 billion years were not able to do. In addition, though, Aubrey de Grey made a very interesting point. He said, and when we do so, we will make sure we have gone to the past in order to legitimate this, to try to find some species that has already been able to do this. Right? So in other words, what he was suggesting, and he was suggesting this as kind of a humorous remark, but I think in a way it says something about what the role of the historian might be with regard to informing future legitimating narratives with regard to what the human condition is. Because I think there's a tendency, and again, this is part of the sort of Foucauldian hang-up, right, as it were, that if we're going to talk about any conceptions of the human, we've got to be critical and deconstructive, otherwise we're not doing our job. Okay. But one of the things that, of course, historians can do, especially when they're opening up spaces of things that have been forgotten and neglected, is, in a sense, providing the potential foundation for what the next generation's narratives are going to be. Because the next generation's narratives, insofar as they're going to break with the current narratives, are going to need some legitimating story, and it's probably going to come from a part of the past which people up to this point had been neglecting. Okay? So the whole idea of coming up with all these alternative pasts, which has become increasingly popular, especially in this field, is actually providing legitimatory resources for whatever breakthroughs and changes in our self-understanding might have in the future, where in a sense you want to make the argument that, look, we're thinking about human beings in a radically different way, well, in which case then we're going to have to appeal to a different past from the past that the other people have been appealing to. And so then it becomes very important to actually have on hand as a kind of reservoir, as it were, of all of these alternative paths that can be used to legitimate things. Okay? And so when I read the journal history of the human sciences, that's kind of how I read it, okay? I mean, I don't, because I'm someone interested in the future primarily, okay? I'm not interested in the past for its own sake, okay? Sorry, Roger. I mean, I'm a man of the future, but I think the only way you can really get a grip on the future is by having as deep an understanding of the past as possible. And so all those alternative pasts become incredibly important as resources that one can rely on to think about how we could have gotten to where we are now, okay? Especially if you want to support something. Because at the moment, the way we tend to use those alternative pasts is just as way, in a kind of almost throwaway critical way. We just say, look, you know, the history need not have been that way. These possibilities were closed off. If we allowed those possibilities, we might have had a different future, right? This is like Chapin and Schaffer and all that nonsense, right? Where in a sense, what you do is you show, right, that the history could have been otherwise if somebody listened to Hobbes, for example, and Leviathan and the Airpoke. Right, but the point is, that's not the only use of it. It's not just saying, you know, things could have been better, but rather those alternative histories are still there to be used, potentially, to provide legitimating resources for what might come up in the future. Okay? And insofar as we don't want to think about stuff in the future as purely science fictional, right, because that's the big argument that often gets used about the possibility that the human condition might be different in the future, is that, hey, when you say that people could live 1,000 years and all the rest of it, that's just science fiction. Nevertheless, if you could show that there are credible sources in the history that actually, in a sense, were closed off for quite contingent reasons, but nevertheless could, in some sense, be seen as having been predecessors and could be carried to this day, then I think you can engage in a much more contemporary discussion, which I think would inform not just our understanding of the past, but our understanding of the present situation today. And I'll stop here, okay?